This is Wells Tech, a weekly show exploring the intersections of technology and ministry. Your hosts are Sally Draper and Martin Spriggs. Wells Tech is produced by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod.
Welcome back, everybody, to Wells Tech. This is episode 524 for November 21st, 2017. My name is Martin Spriggs. And this is a little show about technology and ministry we do each and every week where we try and figure out what it all means and some of the technology that the Lord has made available to us and how we best use it in His service. And helping me do that each and every week, Sally Draper. Hey, Sally, how are you?
I am very good, Martin. Happy to have made it to Thanksgiving week 2017. And I was just reflecting a little bit this week on things I'm thankful for, and Wells Tech definitely rises to the top of the list. It's been nice. A good year for technology and ministry, and, not just the things that we talk about on Wells Tech, but how we've used technology to serve the Synod and our roles for Synod, and just the progressions that are constantly being made are a positive thing for ministry, and that's exciting to see.
It's like you got a little sunshine on your shoulder today.
Yep, sunshine on my shoulder. There's a song in that, I think.
Making you happy?
Pretty day. Unfortunately, if you step outside, you very quickly realize that it's just for looks. It's not for being outside in, because the wind is super strong today. Very cold day.
Those of our listeners that have been following along in this month of November, as the weather gets cooler, our conversation gets a little warmer, heating up about security, which is a really hot topic these days, as we're trying to figure out how best to keep our stuff secure, not just our own stuff, but the stuff of those people maybe that we're responsible for protecting, maybe that be family members or faculty, staff, our organization in general. And that's getting harder and harder as those people who want to do bad things are finding it easier and easier to do so. But there are tools out there, and this discussion hopefully is helpful as we've been talking about different ways to keep the bad guys out and keep our stuff safe. And we have yet another interview this week. We found some more people who are smart on security. And Sally, they live up in your neck of the woods.
They do, actually. We took some time to visit with Jim Rachi and Kim Jones, both employed at Martin Luther College in the network services area. And I actually had the privilege of officing in that space a few years ago, and have the highest respect for the work that they do there, because if you think it's hard keeping your church and school, whatever size it is, on the straight and narrow in terms of all the different scams that are out there and things that people can click on, just kind of multiply that exponentially by the size of the Martin Luther College campus and the number of staff members and students that they have to support. And I think they do a fabulous job combating, you know, real world. It's like a battlefield out there. And as soon as one thing is put down, something else comes up that you got to go to battle against. And so it's exciting to hear about the tools and things that they use to do that battle.
So without further ado, let's take a listen to our interview with Jim Rachi and Ken Jones.
Joining us today on Wells Tech are friends from up the hill from where I'm located. We've got our technology specialist from Martin Luther College joining us, including Jim Rachi, Director of Information Technology, and Ken Jones, and we're going to call him a PC guru today. He gets to deal with lots of fun things on a campus of 700 plus students, so we're going to learn a little bit about that today. Happy to have you guys joining us. Thank you.
Welcome, guys.
And maybe if you want to start by just introducing yourself a little bit, tell us a little bit about your job responsibilities and family, church, whatever you want to share.
Well, I guess I'll start. I'm the Director of Technology. I've been here, this is my eighth year now at Martin Luther College. And it's been a blessing for me to work here. I enjoy it very much. I'm kind of in charge of anything that's technology-wise, I guess you'd say. The computers oversee the network, the phone system. Sometimes there's a joke, anything that you plug in, we have to take care of, but it's kind of how it goes there. Mm-hmm. I'm a member at St. John's here in town, and my wife, Pat, is with me up here. Our kids are all, they have left the nest. Several of them are called workers in different parts of the country, and we kind of followed them. They came up here first, we came afterwards, so.
Awesome.
Michigan boy, right?
That's right.
Okay. Ken, what about you?
Well, I'm Ken Jones. I've been at Martin Luther College for 17 plus years now.
Wow.
Started way back in 2000. Get to deal with the everyday crisis of the students' computers being infected, malware being distributed among faculty and staff, deal a lot with putting together computers, repairing computers. I'm a member of St. Paul's Church. Have been a member of theirs. I actually got married there in 1980. So, my wife is a former first grade school teacher. She taught for 20 years in St. John's in Watertown.
Always those Wells connections all over the place. So you alluded a little bit to the day-to-day crises that go on with a large student population. Maybe you could give us an idea of what a day in the life of a security expert there at MLC looks like. What kind of things come walking through the door there?
All sorts of things come walking through the door here. Usually I read about a virus or malware, and within a few days, I see it here with the student population being on the net all the time. It doesn't take long for something to show up here. I'll have a day where it's totally quiet, and then the next day I'll have 9 students in a row come in, one after another, with various forms of my computer doesn't run, it's running slow. My antivirus said it had something, but I'm not sure what. So it takes a while to kind of, you have to be more of a detective to figure out what's going on. And, you know, sometimes you have to do a lot of looking into logs and stuff on the computer to find out what actually happened. And then a little more digging with the student to find out, well, maybe I clicked on something that it's one of those things where you tell them, if you weren't expecting it, don't click on it.
Definitely great advice.
So from a proactive standpoint, as you see these things coming in the door, you obviously want those to not happen so you don't have to deal with those. What kind of steps can you take either with faculty, over which you probably have a little bit more control over the computing experience that they have, or the students? Do you install antivirus software? Do you do training? What kind of things do you do to be a little bit more proactive so these things don't come walking in the door?
A lot of it is making sure that their antivirus is up to date, making sure their computer's up to date. It's surprising the number of computers that, well, I haven't clicked on update. It kept on popping up, but was always inconvenient. So I won't click on the update now. And that's usually where most of the stuff happens, is because of that. Mm-hmm. So the proactive part is, you know, make sure your computer's up to date. Make sure the software's up to date. Windows 10, the antivirus that's built into it now with the fall creator update is very good. Another problem I'll see is that they believe more than one antivirus is good, which is not a good thing because they tend on conflicting with each other, slowing the computer down, which in that turn, then they look for something on the internet to speed their computer up, which is not a good thing to do. You end up dying things you shouldn't.
Okay. What kind of policies do you have in place, let's say, for faculty and staff? Do you have an established antivirus that must be installed and kept up to date, or is it, what's the policy or practice there?
Well, our faculty laptops are, we all have the same image on it. We ask them to keep the Windows 10 updates up to date. And recently with our firewall, we purchased another client-side device that they load locally on their machine that's supposed to help with this cryptovirus. It recognizes the patterns and should shut the computer down right away. So hopefully we won't have any problem with that. We had a couple instances last year. I think one or two faculty members of the can and a couple kids. But that's one of our major concerns, is getting that cryptovirus in our network. So we've been pretty successful there so far.
And the cryptovirus would maybe be commonly called ransomware. Is that what it results in? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
So somebody encrypts your device, so they are the only ones that can decrypt it, and you got to pay them to get access back to your data.
Correct. So most of our lab machines and things that we have, we don't worry about that because they are locked down and things are not saved to it, so it's no real danger if they get locked up with a cryptovirus, but we can always reboot those and start fresh. But the faculty laptops are the ones that we're concerned about, and also any of the staff members that work day-to-day here on campus. So those are the ones that we really watch out for. We started last year with a service that sends out phishing emails, fake phishing emails, and lets us know who clicked on what and that type of thing. It's called Know Before. And along with that were some training videos that we sent to all our faculty and staff to go through the training videos. And I think we're making progress, because a lot of times people are calling me now, I don't even want to open your email anymore. Because
they're paranoid, a good paranoia, right?
Yeah, it is good. People should not click on links in emails. You can't assume that it's going to go someplace. And there's some clues, you know, they can hover over the link to see if it's legit and so on. But we're trying to teach people that if it's anything to do with your banking or things like that, go to the website yourself. Don't click on a link from an email or anything else.
Even if it seems like it's come from a credible source, like one of the two of you, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Without naming any names, what were kind of the results of that, your first go around with Know Before and sending out your, maybe your initial phishing test?
You know, it's been varied on the type of email sent out. They have a very good variety of things you can choose from, but the one that got the most people was I had one of those Christmas cards last year, you know, like electronic Christmas card, and people opened that and clicked on links. I think 70% of our staff did.
Is that right?
Yeah. It was poorly written or misspelled words and things, but people are used to getting these, Christmas cards or whatever it is in the mail, and they click on it without thinking. So that was a eye-opener.
So what's the experience of the user if they do click on that? Do they immediately get taken to a page that says you've been phished and here's some training videos, or what happens? What's the next step?
That's pretty much what it is. You can have it do a variety of things, but one of the ones that I did, just so they knew immediately that they shouldn't have clicked on the link, is there's a big page that says you've been phished. And the service keeps track of who clicked on those links, so I can send people in through a couple more training videos just to look at things. But everybody has it. Time is something that people don't have a whole lot of, so they don't want to sit through 20-minute training videos. So they do have some little short ones that go through it in a quick reminder. And we encourage people to take a look at those. I'm going to do it for 1 year, but then after seeing the way people click on things, I thought we'd better continue this some more. So we have a lot of new staff members this year, so it might be wise to do it continually.
Does it only work through email, or are there other ways to present something, a pop-up on the computer or Chrome extension or something like that?
We have a lot of capabilities. We could, for example, leave USB thumb drives around.
Okay.
You plug that in your computer, the same type of thing as say you should not do this if you don't know whose it is.
Right.
I've not done that, but there's a variety of things that you can do with this service.
Wow. Well, have you tried that at all with students, or is it just faculty staff that you've done that training with?
I've only done with faculty staff. I have sent out blanket emails to students warning them about things, but the cost was too prohibitive to do all the students too, so we just have been doing faculty and staff.
And word of mouth gets around pretty quick with the students. If I get in with something, you know, the pop-up, the one that's currently out there now, is it'll come up and say, Microsoft is going to close your or shut down your IP address because running out viruses and all this, call this 800 number. And they call the 800 number, and, well, for $275, they'll take care of your problem. And they want to have you install a remote login program on your computer, which they do. Several of them have done that, and I've managed to get them to inform their banks and credit card companies to stop payments and go through there. And the biggest problem they have is in Chrome and Edge, it's a video loop. You can't close out of it. The only way to get out of it is actually shut your computer off. Hmm. So they get more and more creative every time.
Yeah.
Once I see one, then I'll tell the student about it. And usually about in the same day, I'll see two or three more come in. And then I tell them about it. And then pretty soon it's like it dies down because word of mouth gets around pretty fast with the students. Hmm.
Go ahead, Sally. I'm sorry.
I was just thinking about our churches and schools that don't have a Ken Jones doing detective work for them. What kind of advice would you give them if they're, you know, too small for an employee that has that kind of expertise and just to rely on software solutions? Or what could they do if they were encountering some of these kind of problems?
Boy. And there's a lot of study you have to do to, you know, if in doubt, don't click. I mean, that's the biggest thing right there. And if something does come on, shut the computer off. Turn it off. If you can't get out of a, you know, something that's on your screen, shut your computer down. If you start it back up and something comes up, then it's time to call somebody that's got more expertise.
Yeah, there is no substitute for experience and some expertise, and I think anybody responsible for technology on a campus, you know, no matter how small, needs some degree of knowledge about this. And there's certainly a lot of information. And like you mentioned, there are products like KnowBefore, and we're actually bringing in a new software vendor to Shopwell's similar product from Sophos. That is fairly reasonable to enable, and I think prevention is certainly where it's at, as you've mentioned, Ken. Talking about prevention, then maybe thinking about the onboarding process, that's maybe a good time to get with a new staff member, new faculty member, and do some education. Has that changed over the years now that you got to be a little bit more aware of security? Do you spend a little bit more time? Is there a kind of an approach that you take with somebody coming, you know, fresh onto the campus to make them aware of these things?
Well, actually, I'd say no. I don't think we have, really.
Okay.
That's a good point. It might be something that we go into, but we try to cover things, you know, with this, like the KnowBefore. They're aware of it. I usually talk at our opening faculty staff meeting saying you're going to be getting some phishing emails throughout the year. Mm-hmm. The first time I introduced it, I said, a lot of you got an email today, and that kind of introduced it. And so it has opened, made the staff more aware. They definitely are leery now clicking on links and emails, and I think that's the most important thing. All the phishing that goes on. Most of the attacks now are through the emails. Ken and I were talking a little bit earlier. We don't see a lot of the drive-by things on websites anymore that pop up. out so much. It's more directed, and they're getting more and more intelligent all the time. Some of these people will do research on the company that they're trying to fish and find out the actual names of the CEOs or whatever the case is.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if they're trying to get money. So,
right. And the web browsers now have gotten better in Opera, Chrome, Edge all have pop-up blockers or ad blockers. Ads are usually where most of drive-by malware comes from. And a lot of them are enabled by default now where they weren't before.
So just in listening to the conversation, it sounds like you'd probably be pretty confident if you sent out that same Christmas card that the results would be better this year.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. I think I'm about due to send out another fishing attempt here. See what I can catch.
All right.
Get a whirl.
Very good. Well, we really appreciate the time you guys gave us this afternoon. I think it'll be a big blessing to those that follow our podcast as they get more and more aware to not click on those links and hopefully educate the people and their staff and faculty as well. So. Good stuff.
Thanks you guys for joining us. Blessings on your work there at MLC.
Thank you. Thank you. Same to you. Blessings on your work.
Thanks again to our fellow co-workers that labor in New Ulm, Minnesota at Martin Luther College. I guess I don't envy what they do in the least. I mean, they have a never-ending battle trying to keep all that faculty, staff, students protected. Day in and day out.
Definitely. I think they earn their capes every day. They're true superheroes in the cybersecurity realm. And I really found it very interesting that they've used this tool KnowBefore that they described to kind of make people aware and train them on security challenges with phishing scams, because it seems like that's come up in the last few weeks as being the number one thing that we're really fighting against. So interesting that people are figuring out ways to educate in very creative ways by actually simulating those phishing scams.
Right. And in our Wells Now segment, we'll talk about another product that is just made its appearance in the ShopWells program that is kind of a competitor to KnowBefore, but does a lot of the same things that some of our listeners may be excited to learn about and take advantage of. One thing I did want to mention is that there are a couple of obviously common sense things, as they mentioned, that you can do to kind of keep yourself safe. One thing that we try and train our people on is just those links that appear in emails or on websites. Just hover over them, you know, use whatever tools that your browser provides to take a look at where those are going and inspect those URLs. Sometimes they look very similar or are somewhat familiar, but if you look real close, they're not trustworthy. They're going to a site that you're not expecting. And I think we've said it on the show, and I don't remember if they said it in the interview or not, but if it's a bank or some site that you know the direct URL to, don't click on the link, but actually type it in yourself so you know exactly where you're going. I always do that with my bank, even if they are sending me emails. And then I guess the statement, all is not lost. If you actually fall victim to some of these things, to these phishing schemes, if, and it's a big if, you have two-factor authentication turned on for whatever site it is that may have compromised your security. Because even if you've clicked a link and maybe given up credentials to a site unknowingly, if you have a two-factor authentication turned on, they only have one piece, one key of a two-lock system, so they're really not going to be able to get in and do anything illegal or something that would not go well for you, because you've got that other two-factor that they don't have access to, whether that's an app on your phone or a text message that comes to your phone to change your password, those kinds of things. So that really highlighted for me the importance of having two-factor authentication, especially if it's available. And more sites are offering that, especially those that require a higher level of security like banking, Amazon, those kinds of things.
Yeah, we talked about that in our first show this month, Martin. And, admittedly, It's not the most pleasant thing to have to go through.
It's a pain. It's total pain. I know.
But I think you'd have to just be saved just that one time to sing its praises forever, because having it there can definitely save your digital life and exposure to the bad guys and things.
But I found paying, a really good article. Insurance. You never really like paying insurance because you never know if you'll actually get your money's worth out of it, but it just takes that one time, that one accident, for you to really appreciate it.
Yeah. Circling back to what you were saying about mousing over and things like that, I found a really good article to link to in the show notes from CNET, How to Spot a Phishing Email. And it's a pretty recent article. And they actually show some screenshots of things, like watch for poor grammar or misspelled words or things like that. They also show examples of how they can kind of spoof your server and change things about, like it might say Google but be misspelled, or have another domain at the beginning of it with a misspelled Google or something. So, just some key things to kind of be aware of there.
Yeah, very good. I'm going to take things out of order here, Sally, just to kind of keep the flow going. We mentioned about a competitor to KnowBe4, and that is something from a company called Sophos, and that's kind of our Wells Now segment. They have a product called Sophos Phishing, and we recently signed a contract with them for a negotiated price that is available to any of our organizations for $4.80 per user per year. You can take advantage of this Sophos Phishing product. And essentially it works the same way Jim described KnowBe4, where it allows you to take create a campaign that would send out pseudo phishing type emails to a given set of users in your organization. They do actually have to have a minimum of 5 users. So you're going to pay 5 times $4.80 at a minimum. But that's an extremely cheap price for an excellent product. And not only do you get these campaigns that you can send out and some of the things that go along with that about automated training and those kinds of things, you can actually store some of your policies and your different helpful announcements about security on that site. So it kind of becomes the security central for your organization, where you can direct people to learn not just about phishing, but some of the other security things that you want them to pay attention to. So not available on the Shopwell site yet. We'll put a link in the show notes to the product itself, which is their phishing threat management solution for $4.80. But if you want to jump in early, just contact the show directly, wellstech@wells.net, and we will get you hooked up with the right people. Very soon we'll get it on the Shopwell site, and you'll just be able to contact them directly. But for now, if you want to take advantage of this $4.80, and this will be around for at least a year until we see what kind of volume goes through the program, but that's an excellent price for some level of confidence that, hey, we're doing some things with our faculty, with our staff, that is helping them get a little bit smarter about protecting their data.
So that begs the question, Mr. Spriggs, will we be doing this in the Wells Technology Office or in the CMM at large? And if so, when can I expect that email so I know not to click?
Coming to an inbox near you, but I'm not telling you what it will be or when it will come, Sally.
Be so ready.
Huh? If you're on the naughty list, we're going to have a conversation.
A conversation probably with a few of our Wells Tech friends in the witness.
Right, exactly. So all right. Take advantage of that. That's our Wells Now segment. We skipped over our normal number two hitter in the batting lineup, and that's our news and tech segment. And this is kind of exciting news. I don't know if you felt it was as exciting as I did, Sally, but Twitter's made a change. It's Twitter times 2. I'd like to call it. They made a change to their policy. It used to be 140 characters that you were limited to. Now they've expanded that to 280 characters. What will you ever do with 280 characters of tweets? That's, I guess that's the question, right?
It's just hard to imagine Twitter changing. I just did a quick search and found that they started in March of 2006. So for 11 years, they've trained us to be very brief in what we have to say. And now the whole world has opened up to us with 280 characters. That's huge.
They do have a little graph on here in all their research, and they have all the data, of course. With 140 characters available, 9% of tweets hit the limit. Now, I'm not sure how they gauge that, because we all knew that we had 140 character limit. But maybe if you were butting up against that or tried to send it, they track that. So 10%, basically 10% of all the tweets hit that limit. I know that there were occasions where I had to fight pretty hard to get under 140, because I wanted to maybe have a little bit more proper grammar. I'm sure English teachers are probably appreciative of the 280 character bump that you can actually put a period in once in a while and not have that count again, not have that infringe on your ability to communicate effectively.
You know, I think it from a social media curator's perspective, where you're trying to come up with content and share it on your different channels and things, I think it'll be a real blessing, because I do use a lot more characters than that when I'm sharing on Facebook or Google Plus or even on Pinterest describing something I'm pinning. And oftentimes if I use something that's doing the work for me to push out all that content to the different social media channels, Twitter's just this anomaly that I have to go and rewrite basically to get it to fit.
So right.
I think that'll be a huge help for folks that are in that position trying to.
Although just because you have 280 characters doesn't mean you ought to use them if you're not using them effectively. Perry Lund tweeted with hashtag WellsTech, do we really need 280 characters? And I'm sure 280 characters in the hands of some is too much, but we'll see.
We shall see what Twitter will be like now.
All right. So I think that's good news for many. I mean, I'm looking forward to the expanded space. So we'll see how it goes. It's only 280 characters after all. Let's move on to our picks of the week. And it's always ladies first on Wells Tech. So Sally, what's your pick for the week?
Happy to share a follow-up announcement related to Hour of Code. Let's see. Hour of Code is scheduled for 1 week away, 2 weeks away, December 4th through 10th. That must be 2 weeks away. And you can definitely still get in on the fun. You can go to hourofcode.com and sign up to be part of it, volunteer to lead an hour of code introduction for students in various settings. And the information's all there on the website. But what I specifically had to announce today is related to their learning activities. So they give you a variety of things, and it's a real cool shopping cart kind of experience where you can drill down to if they'll be on mobile devices, if they'll be on Android versus iPhone, if they have poor or no internet, if you're interested in topics around certain areas of the curriculum. And then there's grade level breakdowns as well. So they've got coding opportunities for all of those. And many of them are very kid-friendly because they're around things like Minecraft or Star Wars or whatever it may be that might engage children and get them into the coding methodology. They can design their own Flappy Bird game or whatever it is. The one that I wanted to specifically point to today was a new activity being introduced by Google. Google has a website called CS First, and they've actually partnered now with Hour of Code, and they have one activity for designing your own Google logo. And everybody enjoys creative Google logos. Well, what they've done is they've put together a whole series of videos that actually demonstrate how to animate and do different things with the Google logo. And when you go into it, it actually goes to Scratch, a programming environment developed years ago now by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where they actually give you the Google logos as different sprites, and then you can program it, and they actually walk you through how to do it in the videos that they provide, but you can program it to do all kinds of things. I worked through their example of doing costume changes where the logo's actually changing with different imagery that they provided to do some testing. But they have videos on teaching the Google letters to say something, changing their color, adding a backdrop, jumbling the letters around so they move around on the screen, drawing your own Google letters, making them spin or dance or disappear or bounce, all kinds of fun things that you can do with the Google logo and Scratch. And so that's just one of the many activities with the Hour of Code, but this one looks like a lot of fun. And they kind of just hold your hand right through the process. Students can watch the videos individually and move at their own pace or jump around. If one's interested in costume changes and another's interested in jumbled letters, they can do whatever they want, pick from the options there. And it's a great introduction to all the different types of coding that's available through Scratch, because you can make things change colors and have motion and have sounds and control backgrounds and all kinds of things. So great example. Still time to get in on Hour of Code. The dates are December 4th through 10th, and there's lots of support resources available for you, so check it out.
Interesting. I was just thinking maybe I would introduce a week of this to my class. I'm doing a class on web page design, but we do a lot of coding there, of course, and this might be something, just kind of a nice diversion for them. We're kind of in the throes of, a 12-week course. It's kind of a nice refresher. So are most of the lessons really designed for an hour in your experience?
I think you can get pretty far through them in an hour, but I doubt that exhausts everything that's there. I think it's enough to get you really hooked, But definitely, if you know nothing about coding, you could sit down and dedicate an hour to it, even as a pre-reader, and have an understanding about giving the machine instructions and seeing the effects of it.
Very good. All right. My pick is a new version of an old application called Firefox. Many of us, probably one of our first browsers was Mozilla. I think it was called Mozilla back in the day, or Netscape, you might remember. Firefox is an open source project, and they've made a browser for many, many, many years, and they have kind of reinvented themselves. They've done kind of a ground-up redesign of their Firefox browser, which they call Firefox Quantum. Their little tagline is fast for good. So obviously the implication is that this browser is fast. So what I did was I switched over to Firefox for this past 4 or 5 days to see if I could live in this new browsing environment. I've mostly live in Chrome at this point, which I'm pretty happy with. But I would say that there are a couple things that are minor annoyances that I thought, well, maybe Firefox would be better at. And I will say that I believe it is faster. At least it seems faster. I didn't do any scientific studies. But I would say in some cases it definitely seemed to render the page faster for me. Another selling point that Firefox or Mozilla puts out there versus Chrome at least is it's 30% lighter, so less memory usage. And I truly believe that, and I did some checking, and that definitely seemed to be the case, that its memory footprint seemed a lot smaller. Chrome is notoriously a memory hog, and depending on the power of your computer, that can be a problem. So I think Firefox did a lot of kind of optimizations, and I think they've done a nice job with that. Smooth browsing, whether you've opened 10 or 1,000, switching between tabs is faster than ever with Firefox's new responsive engine. So Sally, those 1,000 tabs that you have open doesn't sound like it would be a problem with Firefox. They've got all the kind of the normal things, bookmarks, autofill, passwords, history, private browsing. They have done a nice job with this. And I would say, I don't know if I'm going to stick with it, but I would say it was a good experience in general. I have not tried the mobile version, so they rolled out a mobile version with this, and there is an advantage to doing that where it'll sync up the history and will allow you to kind of keep going with different sites that you opened up on one or the other from the other platform. So that'd probably be my next test, is to see how they've done on the mobile side. But thumbs up from me. I think the product is a good one. And if you're looking for maybe a change, or you're running into problems with whatever it is you're currently using, Firefox may be a viable alternative.
Excellent. I'm glad that you're willing to go out there and try new things, because I'm willing to stay where I'm perfectly happy. I am a Chrome girl through and through, so I guess I could be convinced to try something different.
Yeah, but. Yeah. One of the things that I'm always worried about in switching browsers is the extensions. Mm-hmm. And one good thing about Chrome extensions is most of them are available on Firefox. Most developers find it pretty easy to translate those onto the Firefox platform. I don't know if it's the same code base or not. I kind of think there must be enough similarities. Very different than, let's say, Microsoft Edge, which I think you have to kind of start from scratch, in Safari as well. So that is my pick of the week. All right, we should probably move along to our ministry resource segment. And I am up this week, and kind of a nice segue when I'm talking about my pick of the week being Firefox. I decided to write up a little bit of a blog post entitled How to Pick a Browser. It occurred to me, Sally, that we probably spend a majority of our computing day in browsers. And that didn't always used to be the case, but now more and more when we use tools like Trello, which are web-based, and Google Docs and Google Apps and all the things that the web offers. A lot of that happens within a browser. So I felt it was maybe good to talk about what I call the five considerations of picking a browser. So as you're trying to figure out what is the best thing for me, and you've made that choice, you said Chrome, but there are reasons that you pick Chrome. And I tried to kind of highlight what some of those reasons might be, or some of the reasons that might be important to an individual as they're picking a browser, because it is an important decision, and there are differences. So the five considerations were security, convenience, performance, bookmarking, and extensibility. And I'll just talk briefly about each of those. Security, obviously, is pretty simple. And I think all the browsers in general do a pretty good job. And I found a neat article called Which Web Browser is Best for Security. So if security is your thing, you may want to read that. It's a pretty close horse race, but I think in general I came down on Chrome kind of edging out the competition, mostly because of the frequency of their updates. So the more frequent a browser is updated, the chances are they're going to catch some of the vulnerabilities. Now, on the flip side of that, Chrome is such a popular, it's the most popular browser. A majority of computers are running Chrome. I'd say, I think that was about 55%. Because it's so popular, then there's more attacks against it. If you're on the Mac side, I'd say Safari, again, because it's less of a target and there are fewer people using it. So security is kind of a big one. That's why I put it at the top. Convenience, I think all browsers, what I really say, are chock full of, you know, features that make them convenient to use. But some do things a little bit differently. And, you know, we talked about, you know, the extensions and some of the other things. Syncing is another thing. Saving pages for offline or later viewing. Tab management for a lot of people is huge, so that would be a convenience that might be a consideration. If you have a lot of tabs open, the ability to save tabs or collect tabs, that kind of thing. incognito or private browsing, customization of the address bar, the search bars. So those are all things that I would call convenience. And I think Chrome is still the king there. They have probably more than anybody else of the features that may make your experience more customizable and convenient for you. Then I talk a little bit about performance, and I already mentioned that Firefox, I think, has probably got the edge on performance, but I think Microsoft Edge is also very performant. I think I did a review on that not too long ago as well. I'd say both of them are probably faster than Chrome. So if performance is very important, the amount of memory they take, the CPU usage, so when you're looking at pages, your fan's starting to go on, you know, maybe that's a problem, and you want to maybe consider another browser for performance reasons. Bookmarking is huge. Clearly, when you're dealing with websites as applications, you want to be able to get to them quickly and easily. So bookmarking is really important. I do comment in the blog post as I like the way Firefox, Chrome, and Safari handle bookmarking. I don't think that there is a clear winner here. I would say that if bookmarking is big on your list, then maybe stay away from Microsoft Edge. I think that's still an immature area of their product. But I don't think it's hard to go wrong with Firefox, Chrome, or Safari in the bookmarking area. And then finally, extensibility. And what I mean by extensibility is the ability to add or extend the capabilities of the browser. And Chrome is, I think, really king there with their extension set. And that's what you mentioned, Sal, as being important to you. Things like AdBlock, LastPass, OneNote, Shareaholic, Authy. I mentioned Draft last week, Pinboard. Those are kind of my big ones that always go in a new installation. So if extensibility is really top of your list, then Chrome is hard to beat. But the other ones, you'll have capabilities in that area as well. And as long as the extensions that you want are available on the browser platform, then you're pretty good. But again, Chrome has a much broader list of those extensions. So in general, most of the browsers are on equal footing, but there are going to be sweet spots in these different areas. So I thought I'd put that all together in a little blog post, and hopefully that's helpful.
You know, you should have maybe asked me to proofread before you went live with this, though, Martin, because I see an extension missing in your list. You didn't say Pinterest. I'm sure that you have that red P icon happening.
Let me check. Actually, I did not put it on Firefox. My sincerest apologies, Sally.
Yeah. I have to say, of your five items that you listed, I'm all about convenience, security, all that other stuff. Yeah, that's
boring. Oh, I don't even want to hear that. Oh, my goodness.
But I think one thing you might add, seriously, is that Chrome is backed up by a whole slew of products with Google. So I know that it's not that I can log into my Google account in the other browsers and things, but I think I have a better Google experience if I'm living in that system, you know, with Gmail, with YouTube, with all the different Google products, certainly Drive and all the apps that are there. And so I don't know, maybe I just feel better about using Chrome because I use a lot of Google products, but I think there might be a little bit of interwoven connectivity with Chrome to the Google products. That's one reason.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's kind of in that convenience section where, mm-hmm. I mean, if you are kind of in that ecosystem, it's kind of like, you know, choosing Apple or Android. If you've got some skin in those games, it's going to kind of flavor what you do. If you're a big Google person, you're probably maybe going to lean toward an Android phone because you've got a built-in, you know, Chrome browser, for instance. You can't have a default Chrome browser on an iOS system, on an iOS based system like iPad or iPhone. So you got to kind of pick your horses.
I just saw an Apple ad last night that reminds me. Actually, it wasn't an Apple ad. I thought it was an Apple ad.
Samsung ad, I bet.
It was a Samsung ad with the guy going back to 2007 and getting the very first iPhone. phone and getting the next generations. And then he said goodbye and he
went in the drawer. Yep.
Yeah. So
it's funny. My wife commented on that too.
A little tear. No.
Yeah. Yep. Well done, you know, Samsung, I think. Yeah. They do have a point. So,
yeah.
All right, Sally. What do we have for community feedback?
Well, we heard from Maggie Coots. I don't know how to pronounce her last name. She's a member of St. Paul and Lake Mills, and they're thinking about projecting their services, liturgy, hymns, etc. So she was looking to Wells Tech for any information, and particularly asked an interesting question if there was any insider information on the new hymnal project and electronic resources that may be able to aid them in the future. You know, that new hymnal project was always off in the 2020s, something a long way away, but it's getting closer and closer. And I happen to know someone personally who has some insider information on the hymnal project because he's on the hymnal committee. Yeah, so well, that no would secret. Be you, Martin.
It's no secret, but yeah, that's definitely, we'd be foolish not to consider electronic resources when we're pushing out the new hymnal. So we've definitely talked about it. No firm plans, but the ability to project contents of the hymnal is kind of part of our thinking. And whether that's in a tool like a service builder, where you're trying to help a pastor or worship leader put together kind of the service bulletin, or whether that's in other assets like PowerPoint slides or whatever. Those are definitely in the thinking that we're hopefully going to be able to provide something there that would help somebody that or a congregation that needs to put it on the big screen. So yeah, absolutely. I don't think we're ever going to kind of get into the Power Presenter Pro whatever, you know, space where we're building our own projection system, but I think we're going to be friendly to some of those systems and provide assets that might be helpful. So
good to know. Excellent.
So not to worry, Maggie. It's I think there'll be something out there. Sally, I'm really excited about the video of the week.
You know, some weeks it's easier than others, Martin. And actually this week turned into a week where we were struggling to come up with a video idea around fishing. And then I remembered something, actually maybe Kevin reminded me, something that our sons recently shared. And I would call this guy somewhat of a comedian. It's a man named James Veach, and he's done several TED Talks, actually. So he's got some credibility out there. And I've seen videos of his on Mashable and other places as well. But I think his whole stick is around responding to scammy emails, spammy emails, whatever, scams, and engaging them to lead them on and make them continue to work with him and things to see where it would go. And the one we're going to share on Wells Tech this week is called More Adventures in Replying to Spam. Again, it's by James Veach, and it's, I think, from a TEDx or something. But honestly, if you make it to the end of the video and you're not crying from laughter, I don't know that you're human, because it's just hilarious what he puts these poor men, Lieutenant Commander Korama, just goes through all kinds of things to try to get this man to take his diamond shipment. And it's just hilarious and very enlightening to their techniques and things like that. So
education,
enjoy that. And Martin, I guess
good,
I'll go ahead and
clean entertainment. Yes.
Yeah, for sure. Just follow up that there is a legitimate one as well about staying safe from phishing and scams. It's from our friends at Google for Education, and it's a real good educational one. And when I was mentioning earlier, the CNET article, I was kind of in my mind merging together this video I'd watched as well. So this video gets into lots of good examples of how they'll kind of spoof the domain names and things like that. So might even be good to share with students and things like that. It's only about 3 minutes long, but a very good overview. So I think the two of them together, you're all set. You're going to be so wise about phishing and spam and all that stuff that you'll never make these mistakes when your boss sends you test messages. It just won't happen.
And how, just maybe you could get a free toaster.
Yeah. Bonanza.
All right. Sally, what are we going to do next week?
We are going to welcome our friend Rachel Feld back to the show. Rachel joins us every other month as a semi-regular classroom technology correspondent. And this month, she's going to help us dig a little bit into student privacy and security for those that are in a school setting, because things like FERPA and COPPA all come into play when you're dealing with children and personal data of any type. So definitely tune in for Rachel and our wrap-up of our security discussion.
If you'd like to contribute to the show, and we certainly wish you would, go to our show notes page, wellstech.wells.net. There's all kinds of ways to contribute there. You can click on any of the links at the top that take you to our social network habitats. And you can leave us a voicemail there. You can also send us an email, wellstech@wells.net. Send us your own little fishing stories, if you like, or humorous videos, or things that you'd like us to talk about. So you can get all of the ministry resources that we've been doing all year, every week, been toiling over and sending at you. So those are all there, as well as everything that we really talk about on the show. So if you missed something or didn't quite hear something, that is the place to go, wellstech.wells.net. Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed it, and hopefully it was educational and helpful to you in your ministry. And we do hope that you'll come back and bring a friend. So we will wish you well. Have a blessed Thanksgiving, Sally. I forgot to mention that. That's coming up here in a couple days. Enjoy fellowship and family and the rich blessings that keep coming our way. So blessings to all of you, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.